Hello, this is guest host Carol Spindell, and today we're going to be talking with novelist Catherine Minn. This is a recorded interview, so we won't be able to take phone calls. Catherine Minn is the author of Secondhand World, which is just coming out from Knopf. Secondhand World is her first novel, and we're delighted, Catherine, that you could join us today by phone to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, your book jacket says you were born in Champaign, Illinois.
I was, actually. My father got his PhD at the University of Illinois, and I spent my first two very formative years there.
And so I imagine you don't remember Champaign-Urbana.
I actually have some dim memories. I think we lived in faculty housing, and I remember a sandbox.
Ah, well, if it's Orchard Downs, which we all know here, it's a kind of lovely wooded area with a lot of open playgrounds and old apple trees, so I can see you might have some nice memories. Well, we're glad to claim you anyway, even if you did leave very quickly. I know our listeners haven't yet had the opportunity to read Secondhand World, and it's a wonderful read. Let me just say briefly that it's the story of a young Korean-American girl. She's named Isadora by her mother because her mother admires the dancer Isadora Duncan. Isadora, who is called Issa by everyone around her, is caught between her 1970s American high school with its rock concerts and sexual freedom and the Korean values of her parents, especially the strict old-fashioned values of her scientist father. As Issa grows up and she and her parents try to find their way through suburban America, they carry with them a grief for which there really is no consolation, the death of Issa's younger brother, Stephen. One of the most interesting characters in the book is Issa's mother. She's a beauty. She's a bit of a rebel in her Korean family. Could you tell us her story?
Yes. Issa's mother is actually one of a number of daughters from a very high-class family in Seoul, Korea. And, you know, daughters of generation were expected to marry well and to bear their family heirs. And Issa's mom is a little bit different than that. She wants something more for herself. And when she's about 11 years old, there's a fire that takes place in her family compound. And she's very badly burned. And that burning makes her family feel that she's not marriageable, that they can't sort of get a good arranged marriage for her. So she's actually sent to the United States to teach in college as a way to sort of get her out of the way.
Well, she really drives the book in many ways. She's very determined. She has all these plans. She would like Issa to be as beautiful as she is. And her plans for Issa include plastic surgery, don't they?
Yes. One of the things that, I'm not sure if it's still popular, but it was popular a couple decades ago, was for a lot of Asian women especially to have this special eye surgery that would make their eyes look more Western. The idea was to make your eyes look bigger. And Issa's mother has these, they're called, I don't know, they're Mongolian folds which make your eyes smaller. And it sort of opens them up. And Issa's mother naturally has big eyes, round eyes, which are very much striven for as sort of the height of beauty. And Issa doesn't have them, and so Issa's mother really wants her to have this particular eye surgery that will sort of make her eyes rounder.
Issa gets the message from her mother that she could be beautiful or she could be herself, but not really both. And her mother, in a sort of odd contradiction, wants her to repudiate the thing that is physically and quintessentially Korean about herself, her eyelids.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I was interested in was this idea of a daughter who is born of a very beautiful mother. You know, this is something that I remember reading about with Eleanor Roosevelt, whose mother was a great beauty of her generation. And Issa's not particularly pretty. She has other strengths. She's very smart. She's very creative. She's an interesting girl, but she's not particularly beautiful. And her mother her mother is a dreamer and an idealist and somewhat fragile emotionally. And she just refuses to sort of see Issa for herself and keeps wanting for her, you know, this other life. And the surgery is just another indication of how she really gives Issa the message that she's not all right the way she is, that she can always be improved upon, that there's always something that could be corrected.
They talk a lot about eyeshadow, the mother and the daughter, and it becomes almost a medium for the powerful bond between them and how to put it on, how to get it to disappear into the fold, and how the mother is so beautiful in her eyeshadow. But it seems like the idea of beauty is really a struggle for Issa.
She worships her mother, especially as a young girl. And, you know, I think all of us have this sort of memory of watching our mothers at their sort of dressing tables, making themselves up and sort of thinking about what we're going to be like when we're older and so forth. And Issa has these memories. But after, especially Issa's brother's death, one of the ways that her mother sort of grieves or sort of retreats into this sort of dream world is to sort of get more enwrapped with this idea that Issa's going to get this eye surgery, showing or teaching Issa how to be a woman, how to use feminine wiles to get her way. All of those sorts of traditional feminine sort of power that Issa isn't sure she wants for herself.
Yeah, I don't know if this conflict is still so important for young women today. I kind of think perhaps it isn't, and I hope it isn't. But certainly in the late 70s, when Issa was coming of age, young women felt, I think, very torn. You could be beautiful or you could be smart and strong, but not both.
Right. And if you did happen to be smart, you had to hide that somehow. And I think for Issa, you know, this is compounded by the fact that she's Asian. And she's growing up in a suburb of Albany, New York, in a place where there are no other Asians. So not only does she not fit the traditional mold of what's considered beautiful for women, but she's really sort of an alien creature. So even if she were attractive, she wouldn't necessarily have been sort of seen that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Issa's mother is also a passionate reader. She goes back to school, she discovers literature, and I think this is one of the real appeals that she has as a character, because so many of us can relate to the way she gets swept up by the language and the stories and the emotion that she finds there.
Yeah, Issa's mother is a real self-improvement nut, you know, in all ways. And she does get very enamored with especially poetry and the English language, which is something, incidentally, that Issa shares with her. Issa has long been an avid reader. And so in some ways, one of the conflicts between them is that Issa sort of feels like this is her territory and her mother is starting to sort of encroach upon her turf. But Issa's mother also, I mean, she's very much blinded by the fact that she has this poetry professor whom she has a crush on, I guess, is the way to put it. And he is sort of guiding her literary tastes and so forth. And Issa, again, is very scornful of that as well.
Well, in a way, this really is a coming-of-age story. And in another way, it's a very American one. Because there's quite a bit in this novel about the American dream. They have a lovely house in the suburbs of upstate New York. The father has a good job as a professor. In a sense, they have achieved the American dream. And then comes the story of the avocado green dishwasher, which is kind of the symbol of the American dream for that era. But in Secondhand World, the mother's desire for the dishwasher turns out so tragically.
Yes. You know, it's very much suburban America of the 1970s. And my book is, I mean, in some way, it's sort of about the dark side of the American dream, because I believe that for a lot of immigrants, even the ones who achieve, you know, the outer trappings, as Issa's parents do, of this American dream, there's always a cost, and you never know what that cost is going to be. When Issa's mother really, you know, wants to have a dishwasher because they, you know, she's been washing the dishes by hand, and for her, a dishwasher becomes sort of the symbol for everything American and modern and successful. The delivery men who come and actually install the dishwasher don't notice Stephen, who at the time is four, playing in the driveway. So he's actually killed while Issa's mother is at the kitchen window, and she's witnessing this. And it's, of course, as you would imagine, a horrific, horrific thing. Mm-hmm. And she never uses the dishwasher after that. You know, it just sort of sits there in their house, and she continues to wash the dishes by hand.
It seems like, you know, in that scene and in so many other ways, your novel asks the question, you know, what do you have to give up to attain this dream? And for this family, the cost is quite high, isn't it?
It is very high. And, you know, obviously, for many people, it's not so high. But I was interested in this idea, especially the Korean immigrant generation of my parents' generation. They came here after the Korean War. And I think that, you know, the novel is called Secondhand World because none of us are born into the world tabula rasa. You know, there's always some experience that our parents have had that they've lived through. That we may or may not be aware of that will affect how we're brought up and how we come to view the world. And the thing for Issa is that she doesn't know her father is keeping a secret about the war that he hasn't even told his wife. And Issa discovers this only after her parents' death. And it's the idea that, first of all, Korea was divided into two, and many Korean families were just they had somebody, some family member who was taken to the North or was just in the North when the demarcation was made. And they don't know to this day whether or not they're alive or dead. And so there's a real cost there of a war in which a country is just split in half. And it's really the same country. It's the same language. It's just that this division was made by the Russians and the Americans at the end of World War II.
Right.
So it's a very sad story about how we can't escape history in some way. And the Korea that my parents remember doesn't exist anymore. Uh-huh. And for Issa's father, too, you know, he mourns the loss of a country that really was devastated by civil war.
Yeah, he refers to going back to Seoul, and he cannot find where his house was. There's only stones or something.
Yes.
There.
Because there was, you know, there was so much bombing.
Yeah. The idea of secrets is another motif in the book. Issa wants everything out on the table, no matter how painful it is. And in this sense, she's very American and very much a girl of the 1970s. And this question runs through the book, how much do we tell? And is someone happier if they don't know?
Right, and that's exactly the question that Issa poses to her father. And you know, one of the other things that I was centrally interested in when I started writing the book was this notion that when we're younger, we tend to be very judgmental. You know, we sort of see the world in black and white, and it's sort of ironic that, you know, when we have the least amount of life experience, we have the most certainty that we're right, that we see things, you know,
true, clearly.
And for Issa, you know, she's a very strong-willed, very intelligent, in some ways precocious girl, and she just believes that she knows what's right and wrong. And I think that the journey for most of us, and I think the journey for Issa in the book, is towards the realization that the world is a much grayer place, that there's a lot of uncertainty, and that really it's very difficult to judge other people without having really walked around in their shoes. And this is something that, of course, Issa learns at very high cost. But I think it's something that we all learn, that circumstances mitigate a lot of situations and make it almost impossible for us you know, to render judgment on other people.
It's a beautiful story of growing up in that way, because as I read it, that unfolded her certainty, her judgment. And then toward the end, when she really does begin to grow up, she begins to understand more what her parents have gone through. When we first meet Issa, she's a patient in a burn unit, and we don't know the story of the fire, but we know something terrible has happened. And she actually starts telling us her story from her bed. And fire really is a strong motif in this book. It's destructive, but it is also transformative, maybe cleansing. For Issa's mother, as you said, fire was the catalyst. It gained her freedom from her Korean family. And I was wondering, does fire play a particular role in Korean thought or culture?
I'm sure it does. But I think what I was thinking of in some way was more that the idea of, you know, the phoenix from the ashes.
Uh-huh.
The story of the first fire, the fire that brought Issa's mother to the States, is something of a legend that she tells over and over to people. It's something that she feels sets her apart, makes her different, and that brought her actually luck by bringing her to the United States, which had sort of been her dream. And ironically, you know, the fire is caused by an old movie projector, which her father had brought, and it was projecting a movie that came from the States, and she was already very much longing to get out of Korea. And so the second fire becomes, for Issa, in a much more tragic way, that same kind of crucible.
Mm-hmm.
By which her character is formed.
Well, as I read the book and as I thought about it afterwards, I was thinking about pottery, which is so important in Asian cultures. And I know very little about Korean culture, I have to say, but isn't it true that Korean potters are really the ones who immigrated to Japan and reinvigorated Japanese pottery?
Immigrated is a nice way to put it.
Were they taken by force?
Yes,
is that,
actually, yeah. I think that many of the Celadon potters who were sort of most famed in Korea were actually taken when Japan occupied Korea to the island of Kyushu, where many of their descendants still live and still make pottery. And one of the interesting stories, I think this was in the novel originally, I'm not sure if it's still there, is that Korean potters, like many of the Middle Eastern weavers of tapestries, would put a flaw in their pots on purpose, because they believed that only God was perfect. And so each of their vases were, in fact, just nicked or flawed in some small way.
Mm-hmm. It's a nice metaphor, because clay is transformed in the fire. The glass on the surface melts and becomes glaze. It's both beautiful, but it's also very strong functionally. And then the clay vessel is strengthened in the fire, and it's completed in the fire. And so I thought of that as I thought of Issa, and it just seemed to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, she very much transforms. And, you know, she feels responsible for the fire, and for good reason. So, you know, there's a lot to account for her. And I think for a 17-year-old, you know, it's a heavy burden to bear, this kind of guilt.
It is.
And what I wanted, although the book, I think, probably couldn't be accused of being cheerful, but I did want for her at the end to feel in some way that she has survived in a very real sense, and in a sense that's sort of reminiscent of the way her mother had felt.
Uh-huh. Well, I certainly felt that when I read the end of the novel. In fact, I really liked the ending, because as a reader, I could keep on imagining Issa. I could imagine her getting older, and I imagined her doing very well despite all what she's been through. And I imagine her going to college. She's smart. She's observant. She loves language. And, you know, that was sort of one of the pleasures of a reader, was to keep imagining her. And have you ever thought about writing a sequel?
No, I think I'm not interested, although I do think also of Issa very kindly. One of my friends, when he finished the book, said, you know, Issa's going to grow up and she's going to be one kick-ass woman. And I really liked that, because I really do believe that that's true, that she's somebody for whom all of these, you know, in some ways terrible experiences will make her a stronger, more sensitive and aware person, and that she will come out okay.
Another thing that Issa struggles with is that some ways she feels shut out of her parents' marriage, and she feels that her brother, who's no longer alive, is more real to them than she is.
Yeah, that's something that, I mean, Korean culture certainly is not unique. Many, many, many cultures value, you know, the male child, especially firstborn. And Issa feels, wrongly or rightly, that she should have been born a boy because she's the firstborn. And therefore, you know, if she had been born second, then she would have been the one who died. And then her parents would have preferred that. Now, there's nothing, you know, obviously, that her parents say that make her feel that. But she feels it very acutely. And it's something, I think, that is very subtly, you know, contained within the culture. You know, the male, the idea that the oldest male takes care of the parents when they get older.
Mm.
They still, I mean, this still happens to this day. My cousins, this is true for that. They live, the oldest brother lives with his parents. And when he gets married, his wife moves in and takes care of his parents. So the idea of not having a male heir is really difficult, I think, particularly at that time for this Korean family. And so she does feel that after his death, I mean, her mother literally has a breakdown or a series of breakdowns and is in and out of hospitals, and she feels very neglected. Her father sort of throws himself into his work. And I think she feels that her parents, her father really worships her mother too, sort of idolizes her, and her beauty is very dazzling to him. And Issa, again, feels very isolated and left out.
In one of the happiest parts of the book, and I found one of the most entertaining too, Issa falls in love with the boy at her school. And he's a fascinating character, too. He's really a kind of unusual boy. So would you tell us about her boyfriend, about Hero?
Yeah. Well, she calls him Hero. His name is Harold. He's an albino. And he's sort of, I remember when I was in high school, it was the time of Edgar Winter and Johnny Winter, and he sort of looks like he has very long blonde hair. And he's kind of a rock star. In the high school, you know, he wants to be a musician. He wears always this black hat and these sunglasses because many albinos have very sensitive eyes. He's incredibly self-contained. And one of the things that attracts Issa to Hero is this fact that they are both different. They're both regarded as being sort of outside the norm in their school. And yet, what fascinates her about Hero is that he doesn't seem to care. He doesn't even seem to notice. He's just very confident, and, you know, basically he just sort of thinks, well, you know, if people, you know, stare at him or say things, that's their problem. And Issa's so, you know, much more painfully awkward and self-conscious about her own difference that she really is attracted to that kind of confidence. And she and Hero sort of have some kind of, I mean, I really feel that they do have this sort of special connection that comes from understanding what it means to be the outsider.
Well, you do feel that. I mean, although it's young love, you do feel a tremendous sense of connection between them and affection, and they're rebels, and they, of course, think they understand everything that no one else does. And then they set off with a friend on a rather remarkable road trip, which doesn't go very well.
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's interesting. I was talking to someone the other day who had noticed that I had cited Lolita as being one of my favorite novels. And they were talking about Lolita, you know, being sort of an on-the-road novel. And this one section of my novel, which is When They're on the Road. And I was just thinking about transgression. and how Issa longs to flee her family, and the sort of sense of isolation and grief and loss and difference that they sort of embody for her. And so she goes off on this road trip with her, you know, boyfriend who's an albino, and her best friend, Rachel. You know, one of the things that I was interested in is this idea of transgression. And when we're adolescents, especially, you know, transgression is almost how we define ourselves, you know, how we sort of figure out who we are outside of our familial relationships. But for what Issa discovers is kind of scary and, you know, really sort of ends up sort of terrifying her. And I think also one of the other things about this threesome is, you know, this is her best friend and her boyfriend, the people that she feels the most comfortable with in all the world. And one of the things I was interested in, again, is this idea of intimacy and how far can you push intimacy before it sometimes disappears. Mm. You cross a line, and at that point, you know, sometimes there's just no going back over. And that's what happens with Rachel and Hiro and Issa, is that they sort of transgress, they push this line to a point where it all falls apart.
Right. Well, we could have warned Issa that that was going to be a difficult grouping, a threesome with her boyfriend and her best friend, but she forges right ahead and takes off on that bus. And I think as a reader, I was kind of thinking, uh-oh, Issa, this may not be a good idea.
Oh, I know. I know. I think there are many times in the book when you could say that to her.
But we always have faith in her. We always want her to come out of it. We always feel that she probably will, even though it's going to be painful. One of the more nurturing parts of the book is her relationship with Rachel's family. Here she finds a very different household, which is kind of a counter to her household.
Yeah, Jerry and Louise, who are, Jerry is Rachel's stepfather and Louise is her mother. And they actually take Issa in because after the fire that killed her parents, she really has no family. And the burn unit, when she's ready to leave, they don't really know what to do with her. She's supposed to be going to college, but she really isn't quite ready. And so they take her in, even though she and Rachel are no longer particularly close. And, you know, Issa has always sort of coveted this family. And one of the reasons that she loves going to Rachel's house is to spend time with her family. Because they're really quintessentially chaotic, loving, you know, everything in the house is sort of messy. The father makes, you know, trash can load sizes of bread dough and is constantly baking bread. They're sort of, you know, they're sort of hippies, aging hippies. Rachel's mother has a daycare center, and so there are always children checking in and out. And Issa starts, you know, actually helping her with that. And I think in some ways her being able to be in contact with small children helps to heal her at the end as well.
Uh-huh. It's a very beautiful story, really. It's very simple at the end, how she moves in with them. She's healed by their kind of simple acceptance of her. They don't seem to ask anything of her, really. And the being with the children seems to help with her healing. And then also, very importantly, she receives some papers of her father's and finds a sort of journal that he's been keeping. And this is really a turning point for her, isn't it?
Yes. She finds a collection of letters that her father has written. And the thing that's very odd about this is that the letters are written in English. You know, Issa, of course, doesn't speak Korean or read Korean. So even though they're addressed to someone else, she sort of feels like it's her father talking to her. And in the letters, she finds out, you know, her father's secret and a lot about his past, which he would not speak about when he was alive. And it does do a lot to explain to Issa, you know, one of the sort of mysteries of the book is, you know, what happens. In the beginning of the book, you know that there was a fire, that it killed her parents, and that it severely burned Issa, but you don't know how that fire began. And towards the end of the book, you come to understand how, anyway, the police, the authorities have come to view how the fire transpired. But when Issa finds the letters, she comes to another theory. And whether or not she's right, you know, it makes a lot of sense to her. And it sort of finishes this interesting crossover that's been happening in the beginning of the novel and the beginning of her life. Issa worships her mother and feels her father to be an incredibly aloof, distanced character. And when she gets older, as she gets older, she starts to sort of see her mother's more difficult aspects and feels in some ways closer to her father.
It's a very beautiful ending, and it really brings across to the reader that meaning of secondhand world. In reality, of course, I guess we're all in third-hand worlds or hundred-hand worlds.
Right.
But certainly the world she needs to understand is the Korean world that she's inherited, especially her father's secondhand world. And these letters enable her to do that. So it's a very interesting ending, I think. And whether she's right or not in her theories about the fire, perhaps the important thing is that she has her own theory, that she's not being told what happened, but she's now in an independent sort of adult way making her own sense of what's happened to her.
Right. I think that's true. And I think that along with this idea of a secondhand world, you know, that we inherit a world that's not of our making, is also inherent the idea that there's, you know, a lot of beauty. There's a lot of love and a lot of joy also in that secondhand world. You know, when we think of heirlooms or we think of things that we inherit, we often imbue them with a lot of value because they come mm-hmm. from our families, because there's something that's handed down. And I think that that's what Issa comes to also, is to realize the beauty of what her parents were also able to give her.
As a writer, Catherine, how did you start this novel? What came to you first?
I think the seed of this novel was this idea of how judgmental children are. And this was, you know, it came out of something, you know, that, you know, in my personal life. But I was just curious about how this paradox of why when we have the least amount of experience, we think we know everything. And that as we get older, we realize, you know, how much we don't know. And it seems frustrating. And in some ways, you know, as we get older, there's something dissatisfying about, you know, feeling that we don't, that everything is gray, you know, that you can't make these determinations. And so on some level, I kind of envy young people because I feel like, wow, you know, it's so clear, it's so simple to them. And yet, because I'm older, I realize that, you know, it's only simple because you're not taking into consideration a lot of complexities that really don't allow it to be that simple.
Were there aspects or parts of the novel that you struggled with?
Oh, yeah, I think the whole thing. one of the things, you know, I had written a lot of short stories before I wrote the novel, and I believe temperamentally that, you know, you're either one or the other, short story or novel writer, and I think temperamentally I'm a short story writer. So writing something this long just seemed, you know, at times completely impossible. And I knew that the only way that I could do it is to not try to sort of follow the traditional narrative form of a novel.
Uh-huh.
And so if you'll notice in the book, it's comprised of very, very short chapters that are almost sort of vignettes. And I sort of got that idea from reading Mrs. Bridge uh-huh. by Evan Cannell, which is a book that I very much admire. But I just felt that this was the only way that I would be able to sustain a longer work is if I could sort of trick myself into thinking that it was really a bunch of shorter things put together.
And all these short things would just accrue into a book.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
It happened.
And in Mrs. Bridge, what I admired so much is that, you know, by these series of vignettes, you know, you get such a sense of her character. And I think with Issa, too, you know, it's just these little snapshots that sort of build until you really sort of get a larger picture of who she is and who her parents are.
Well, you also grew up Korean-American on the East Coast in this era. And in the process of fiction, you invented this other girl and you told her coming-of-age story. When the book was finished, did you see your life differently because of it?
You know, it's interesting because I had written a lot about Korean-American daughters, and especially their fathers, their conflict with their fathers. And, you know, clearly this came from something in my own life. And, you know, although the novel is really fiction, you know, the whole feeling of growing up Korean-American in an Albany suburb is, you know, very much coming from what I knew. But I think when I finished the book, I felt a sense of completion. I felt a sense of, you know, first of all, I don't think I'm ever going to write about Korean daughters and Korean fathers and mothers anymore. I'm going to, you know, write about something very different. But also just the sense that, you know, I really wanted to honor my parents and their generation and what they went through in the Korean War. And I wanted to tell that story in the only way that I could, which is, you know, through the eyes of this Korean-American character, but about just what they survived, because it's really an amazing thing. My father's high school class lost a third of their members in the war.
Mm.
And almost everybody, as I said, has a member of their family who was taken to the North. So I wanted to sort of be able to tell that story in a way that would honor their experience. And I felt very close, actually, to... and I've always felt sort of inexplicably close to my Korean heritage, even though I was born and raised in this country. I lived in Korea for a couple of years, but don't speak the language particularly well, and certainly in all aspects of my life seem very American. But I have a very strong affinity for Korean culture. I love, for example, there are so many fantastic Korean movies now, and I'm just... Every time I watch one, I just feel, when I hear Korean language being spoken, this feeling of coming home, which I don't fully understand. It's also with Korean food. But I felt that in a very acute way when I finished the book. And when my parents read the book, you know, I think my parents had some difficulty initially reading the book. But they've been tremendously supportive since then, and I feel like it somehow made us closer as well.
That's interesting. I mean, the book really is an immigration story, and these immigration stories really are the American story. And, you know, the Korean-American one, there are so many others. But it really does help us to understand that complex identity that is so dual. Just as Issa is also Myung-hee, and just as you described your affinity for Korean culture, although you feel very American, it's sort of, when you say that to me, I might not really understand it. But when I read the book, I really felt it, and it was very experiential, and it was a very double sort of consciousness.
Well, you know, it's the mark of this country that so many of us came from somewhere else, or our parents or our grandparents came from somewhere else. And, you know, one of the things that I found really fascinating, I was diversity scholar here at my university in New Hampshire for a few years, and I remember reading books about the tremendous contributions that immigrants made to this country. I mean, in some ways, the country was built by immigrants. And so the story of immigrants in America is, in many ways, the story of America itself. And so many people who have read the book have remarked that they recognized something of their own childhoods often, whether their parents had immigrated from other countries or whether, you know, the immigration had happened 3 or 4 generations back.
Mm-hmm.
But this sense of identity being something else, American plus a little bit of this or a little bit of that, some sort of feeling of duality or dual culture.
That's really one of the interesting, I think, parts of coming of age in America that the book explores. Do you think you'll write another novel?
Oh, absolutely. I'm already at work.
Are you?
But I really felt like I wanted to do something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a lot of ways, as you said, this novel, being my first novel, is really sort of a coming-of-age novel. It's a novel about a family. And I wanted to try and challenge myself. So my next novel is going to have a much broader scope.
Uh-huh.
And also because this is such a sad book, you know, it's in a lot of ways a very tragic story. I wanted to try and write something a little lighter, but it's not really in my nature. I think you inherently have either a comedic or a tragic vision, so it'll be a black comedy if it ends up being a comedy at all. But I was interested in exploring this idea of Asian fetishism, you know, which exists not just in our culture, but in many cultures, the idea of a Caucasian man who is a classical violinist who has this thing for Asian women.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to really sort of try and sort of explore that, because it's a type that certainly is familiar to me, but I've never really fully understood it or understood why I would find a character like that somewhat contemptible, and I wanted to be able to really, you know, sort of like him. So it's a novel that's very different because the main character is very different from myself.
And is this novel narrated in the first person also, or is it?
No, it's going to be a third person narration. And actually, there are 3 characters, and the Caucasian violinist is being actually stalked by a Japanese-American woman who's in her 20s.
Oh.
Who wants to kill him. And then there's also a Korean-American woman who's a cellist who has multiple sclerosis. And she and the violinist were lovers 20 years ago. And their sort of lives intertwine. So it's sort of a 3 tiered sort of story in which each of the 3 characters will be sort of followed throughout.
Well, I'll look forward to reading it. I guess I'll have to be patient for a while, huh?
I hope you don't have to be too patient, but yeah, I think I have to get through this first.
Okay, and about Secondhand World, you do have a website, right? And you should tell our listeners how to find that so that they can find out more about the book.
Yeah, my website is www.katherinemin.com. And I have an upcoming book tour, and all of my readings and so forth are on that site, and also if you wanted to find out more about the book.
Well, we're going to have to end, unfortunately. I'm Carol Spindell, sitting in today as host. Our guest today has been Katherine Min. She's the author of the new novel, Secondhand World. It's just coming out. It will be published October 3rd by Knopf. It should be in your local bookstore very soon, and hopefully also in our local library as well. Katherine, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.